minus 5, minus 4, minus 3, minus 2, X minus 1. Fire.
Lights out, everybody.
The creaking door.
Dimension X.
Inner Sanctum Mystery.
Minus one.
Dark fantasy.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Sci-Fi and Horror, brought to you by Duane Old Time Radio. Sci-Fi and Horror features some of the best programs from the golden age of radio, including X-1, Orbiter X, Dimension X, Slot X's, Lights Out, Ray Bradbury, Dark Fantasy, and many, many more. Also, my podcasts are free of ads, so you can enjoy the programs commercial-free. If you would like to donate a few dollars to help me cover the cost of creating these weekly posts, you can donate to my channel. On the bottom of each post, there is a donation link in your preferred podcast player. Anything you donate is extremely helpful and appreciated. Last week we aired the first three parts of Orbit 10 from BBC Radio. And now we're going to air the last three parts of Orbit 10 from BBC Radio. The fourth part of the storyline is called The Voices. Then after that, we have The Frozen World. And then we're going to finish up the series with The Unseen. And these all aired from April 21st, April 21, to May
26, 1961. From London, we present Orbit 10. A play in 6 episodes by Peter Elliott Hayes. Episode 4, The Voices.
This is Tom Lambert again. You've now heard 3 of the 6 tape recordings made by Dr. Hayward Petrie. But on that November night in the college laboratory, when the green rod went into action for the second time, we were very far from halfway to the truth. Even as the 3 of them watched a solid steel lamp dwindle and vanish into the cylinder, they could not dream of what was yet to come. But Dr. Petrie must take up the story for himself. Here is the 4th recording.
Continuation of notes, reel 4. If I had watched it alone, I would have disbelieved my own eyes. But we all saw it. That heavy, jointed lamp shrink to a speck and then literally sucked into the glowing core of the rod. Almost at once, the disturbance, noise, light, vibration began to subside.
Look, do you see? The light's dimming.
And the mist in the cubicle is clearing. But there's no way for it to get out.
It doesn't need a way out. It's being reabsorbed into the rod where it came from.
There's nothing else in there. The lamp's gone completely.
And we wondered what power that thing possessed. Now we know.
Yes.
It can absorb solid matter.
No.
Those objects missing from the shelf are Kirkuish.
Of course.
The way the workbench that thing was standing on seemed to vanish. The dust that was left, they went. The same way as that lamp.
But it's impossible. Solids, gases can't pass through each other. It's a question of densities. It's a law of physics.
Well, one of our laws, perhaps. But must they apply everywhere? Under sufficient pressure, water can be forced through a steel plate. A solid can pass through a gas. But a splinter of superfrozen hydrogen can be driven into a wooden board. It's all a question of applied forces. We only understand these things in our own terms.
Yes, sir, but physical and chemical changes always leave something, some deposit.
Yes.
Look at the rod now. It's gone quite dull. You can see through it again.
So you can.
Just the wires and the gray thing in the center. Nothing else.
No, nothing else.
But that lamp just can't disappear off the face of the earth.
Can't it? After tonight, who are we to say what's impossible? Thank heaven we had that cabinet made. If this had happened in the open...
Yes.
It seems to work more powerfully each time.
Now listen, both of you. I repeat what I said 3 days ago, and this time I mean it. After this, we must never open that cubicle, not for any reason.
No.
All right.
If solid matter can be drawn in, it could be, well, extremely dangerous.
Doctor?
Yes?
The book I was looking at, before Cliff sounded the buzzer, that illustration, I think you're right.
Yes, that organism in the center, it has all the same characteristics, only on a much larger scale. The resemblance is perfect.
And the photograph was of human nerve cells.
Yes, each one perhaps 1/10,000th of an inch in diameter. But the cells that thing is made up of must be 1/4 of an inch across. If that material comes from some kind of living being, for some reason, in some way, enclosed, sealed in, well, the mind staggers at the possibilities. Don't you realize it's simply a question of scale? A human, if he were composed of cells that size, would be... he'd be almost 3 miles high. Later that night, leaving Clifford and Elizabeth on watch, I went alone to my study. I wanted to think. This had suddenly become something far larger than a laboratory problem. This powerful, ruthless mechanism, lying buried for years beneath a Hebridean beach with the sea washing indifferently over it, how had it got there, and, more vital, where had it begun its existence? At last, I picked up the telephone and called Sir Edward Bancroft at his home in Kent. Edward made no comment as I told him the facts. When I'd finished, he told me to come down to Westerham at once and bring my students with me. I wonder now if either of us realized that it was 3 in the morning. I shall always remember that drive through the wet, empty suburbs and later through the black Surrey lanes. And at 4:30, we were sitting in Edward's panelled drawing room around the ashes of a dead fire with the first grey of dawn coming over the Kent hills.
Excuse the pyjamas and dressing gown, won't you?
Yes, of course.
I don't usually receive guests like this, but guests usually come at a respectable hour.
Well, yes, sorry.
My wife's making coffee. It'll be here in a minute.
Perhaps I should have waited until the morning.
No, you did quite right, Heywood. Well, at least you didn't write off the college completely.
Not quite.
And these are the readings you collected.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Radiation level reached 5 runcheons. Temperature down to -11 in 80 seconds. Vibrations up to 12,000 cycles. Quite a lively little gadget, isn't it?
And we lost a lamp.
Yes. Look, Heywood, it's no good our thinking up glib explanations and sticking our heads in the sand. I'm in touch with technological advances pretty well everywhere, and I can tell you that no one has produced anything like this. So, we're forced to consider the possible alternative.
That the cylinder did not originate on this planet.
Not a new idea to you, perhaps.
No, it's not.
We've shot umpteen satellites into space, and some of them have stayed up.
And some of them haven't.
But what do we know about what comes into our own planetary back garden? Practically nothing.
I agree.
This could be our first contact with some other intelligence.
Yes.
The thing probably isn't meant to do any harm. It may be just a complex instrument, hopelessly out of its element, running wild. Imagine Sputnik 99 thumping down on Venus and disgorging sparks, radio signals, and guinea pigs. The inhabitants, if any, would be quite justified in taking a sledgehammer to it and asking questions afterwards. This could be something like that.
Yes, but where in the solar system could it have come from? The composition of the planets is well known. None of them can support the kind of life to bring off an achievement like this.
And I think, sir, our cylinder can bite a little harder than the average guinea pig.
It can.
And it'll take more than a sledgehammer to even chip it.
Yes, so you've seen.
We have indeed.
Well, none of us is qualified to make decisions on this. In the morning, I shall give Charles a ring.
Charles?
Lord Heatherton, the Minister of Science.
Oh, of course.
He lives in Whitehall somewhere. We're getting a little out of our depths, Heywood. I'm afraid officialdom must take over.
Yes, but whatever happens, I must have facilities to continue studying that rod. I can't stop now.
If I know, Charles, you'll have every facility. And the cylinder for the moment seems safe enough where it is.
Oh.
Don't look so glum, all of you. You may have made the most important discovery in the history of our world.
Oh, I hope so, Edward, but... I don't know. I just wish there wasn't something about that thing that makes me want to throw it back into the sea.
That's not like you, Heywood. You're tired. Been going at it too hard.
Perhaps.
We must take this one careful step at a time. Ah, here's that coffee. Yes, poor old Heatherton. Cambridge, he was just rotten at higher math.
I reached home as my housekeeper was laying breakfast. If my unshaven, disheveled appearance was a shock for her, there was one waiting for me, too. Almost at once, the telephone rang. Who? Cardiff University? Yes, this is Dr. Petrie. Thank you. Hello?
Good morning, Hayward.
Morning.
Trevor Hughes here?
Good.
Did I get you out of bed?
No, you didn't.
Good, good.
How is Welsh Wales this morning?
Cold and damp, but better than London any day. Hayward.
Yes?
You asked me to have a look at that colliery, Slan Wesleyan in the Rhondda.
Yes, of course. Now, have I wasted your time?
I got a group of my students doing some detecting, ones who come from that part.
Hold on.
I've a good mind to advise the dean to send them down, every mother's son of them.
Why, what have they done?
A couple of them were keen potholers. They thought this was too good to miss. Worse, one of them had worked in a pit.
Well?
They went to Slan Wesleyan, but everything seemed quiet enough, including the pit keeper who was having a sleep. Of course, there was no way of getting down the old shaft, but did that discourage them? The idiots went down their way, with potholing gear, ropes, lamps, and all the rest. They ought to be shot. Believe it or not, they got down to the level of the first working and went half a mile into the galleries.
Good for them.
Good for...
Very foolhardy of them.
Mad as hatters.
Yes.
Luckily, the pit is still in quite good shape, except for a few small collapses and a little flooding. But at the very end of the east working, Hayward, they say they found a kind of cavern.
Oh, yes?
It must have formed since the pit was closed. And then, clambering about with their lamps, they found something else.
What? What did they find?
An object covered in mineral deposits sticking out of the debris. Tubular, 7 or 8 feet long. They described it as some sort of cylinder.
Oh. So it's not the only one. They didn't try to move it?
No, the air was foul. They had to come up.
Thank heaven for that. Now, Trevor, I can't explain it all now, but they must not go down again.
That is.
We have a similar object here in the college. We...
What?
Yes, and we don't know what it may be.
Have you been climbing down coal mines at your age?
No. No, this was found on an island in the Hebrides. Now we know of two.
Good heavens.
I'll call you later, Trevor.
All right, yes, yes.
And those students of yours, be strict with them. Get them sent down, definitely.
Yes, I should, of course. On the other hand, one could say they showed a good sense of initiative. What are you laughing at?
Oh, nothing. Thanks for your help. Goodbye. Shortly afterwards, the telephone rang again. It was Sir Edward Bancroft. He told me he'd arranged an appointment for me with the Minister of Science, 4 o'clock that afternoon in Whitehall. A cloud of uncertainty was gathering in my mind, a dark, forbidding cloud. And I knew then where the answer lay. I went to Fleet Street, to Tom Lambert.
Well, Doctor, are we in business, or aren't we?
Yes. Lambert, I owe you an apology.
Oh, not at all.
You were right to drag me down to Llan Wethlin. After this, I'll respect journalistic intuition. There is another cylinder in that pit.
There is?
Yes. It was found yesterday.
Well, it was a shot in the dark, but I've had my eye on this longer than you have, Doctor. You know, years ago, I began noticing the way similar reports kept turning up.
Yes?
Well, I hadn't a ghost of a theory for them, but once a journalist smells a mystery...
Oh, I know.
Yeah, well, anyway, I started a private news library.
Just so, and that's why I came. Huh? You showed me some cuttings on the train to Wales. There were about 7, I remember.
Yeah, but they were only a few of them.
A few?
Didn't I make that clear?
No. How many more are there?
You'd better see the file. All of it. Should be in here. And I've only been at this for a few years. Here we are.
Oh, it's very thick. Uh-huh. One cutting dated 1907. Mystery earth tremors in Lincolnshire. 1919, strike at Kent Quarry. Narrow escapes as fissure opens. 1929, frostbite in midsummer. Strange sounds on Exmoor.
And plenty more, going back for 50 years. 40 accounts in all.
40?
And they all have a familiar ring, don't they, Doctor? Maybe even this isn't the whole story. Look, turn to the last sheet. One I came across by accident when I was in Jordan last year.
Syrian village devastated. Humming heard as ground subsides. Green light. Vibration felt in Damascus. Good heavens.
Yeah. And early this year, a half-finished block of flats in Belgrade collapsed without warning. Again, the ground just caved in. And again, workmen talked about a green light. Does that mean anything?
Yes. Of course you don't know. The cylinder in our laboratory emits a green light when it functions.
Good heaven.
Yes. Syria, Yugoslavia. There could be others, perhaps all over the world. Lambert, this is vitally important. All such reports everywhere. Can we get hold of them?
Tall order. The world's a fair-sized place, you know. Yeah, but the Press Association's not so little. If I can get my editor on our side, and the foreign news agencies would play, we can try.
I think I can get you official backing for it. I'm seeing Lord Heatherton this afternoon.
The minister? Is it that high already?
Yes. Look, may I borrow this file of yours? I think he ought to see it.
Yeah, it's all yours. And I just hope that one day that lot might make a news story.
It may yet.
It looks like something pretty big, doesn't it, Doctor?
Bigger, perhaps, than we can even imagine. Soon after 4 o'clock, I was sitting in a long, high room behind Whitehall. A log crackled in an Adam fireplace, its flames reflecting darkly on the disdainful portraits on the walls. Beyond the tall window, a tug hooted on the grey curve of the Thames. Lord Heatherton seemed a quiet, mild-looking man, until his blue eyes suddenly sharpened, and then you felt a powerful mental microscope focusing on you.
Interesting, Dr. Petrie, very. Disturbing, perhaps. But would you say conclusive, any of it?
Well, there's no actual proof of what we suspect.
Right, then you're not a crank.
No, sir.
Well, now, you've given me the technical data, your notes, methodical, as I expected they would be. And I've talked with Bancroft, and he takes it seriously. Now tell me what you think, Doctor. Just what you consider we are up against.
Well, I can summarize. We know of the certain existence of two cylinders. They can cause violent physical disturbances. They can also assimilate mineral and metallic substances. Probably any solid matter.
How do they do it? I want your theory.
Possibly by some means of compressing molecular structures. This could account for the extraordinary shrinking process we have observed. When the object is sufficiently condensed, it passes into the interior of the rod and is absorbed. You might say it's digested without trace.
But this is not limited to single objects.
No. Beneath the ground, the cylinders absorb quantities of whatever strata surround them, soil, rock, sand, and submerged, I believe they even take in seawater.
They seem to have quite an appetite. Mm. And some curious tastes. But this would require energy, a great deal. Where do they obtain it?
It may well be that they can absorb that, too, from any nearby source. Dynamos, electric lines, possibly even heat. There was an occasion when an express diesel engine became drained of power. And at the college, since we've had the thing in the laboratory, the lights often grow dim and the electric lifts work sluggishly.
You mean they can recharge themselves at will, through solid walls, across distances?
It's the only answer. And when they're replenished, they can operate again. That's when the dangerous freezings occur.
I see. And these news reports, do you seriously believe that each one means another cylinder?
Well, not in every case, perhaps, but I think we must accept the existence of, well, a considerable number.
Europe, the Middle East, a network of them. Where does one begin to grasp a thing like this? And you are trying to trace all reports that fit the known pattern.
Yes. It may take some time.
It must be done quickly. I will talk to the Press Association myself. Until we know how far this goes, if the results are significant, some of the sites will have to be excavated. Until then, carry on with your work, Doctor. You'll have my ministry's full support.
Thank you, sir.
Money if you need it.
Thank you.
It's not meter readings I want. I want to know why. What their purpose is. Now, what is nowadays known as the $64,000 question. Where have they come from, Doctor? You tell me.
Very well. I believe they've traveled here from some source in space. They've been guided, directed to bury themselves in out-of-the-way places. They're part of a plan, an operation, devised by an extremely advanced intelligence. They've been falling on Earth for at least 50 years, possibly for very much longer. It seems safe to assume, therefore, that they're still arriving. It was coming nearer. At last we were beginning to glimpse the vast outline which only too soon was to become dreadfully clear. And things were not only happening in London. Since our return, we'd had too much to occupy us to give much thought to where it had all begun, the radio telescope on the Isle of Skara. But on that desolate headland in the control room beneath the huge brooding bowl, McLaren and Garrick were making discoveries of their own.
They're still a long way from breaking down the signals themselves, but you check the calculations yourself, sir. What conclusion would you come to?
The signals faded steadily for 6 months. Now they're growing stronger again. The source moving away from us.
And coming back?
Yes. And these progressions are regular.
Yes.
That means the motion of the point of origin is curved. An arc.
And an arc is part of a circle.
Or an ellipse.
An ellipse?
And that can only mean one thing. An orbit.
Yes.
These transmissions are coming from a solid body orbiting round the sun like a planet, somewhere beyond Pluto. Nine planets and... Peter, do you realize what this could be?
Yes, what every astronomer has been wondering since Pluto was discovered in 1930.
Yes. Well, the universities must see these figures and... No, I must discuss this with Petrie first. We need his opinion. I'll send him a telegram and go down to London for a few days.
Right, sir.
I rather want to see what he's making of that wee souvenir he took home with him.
Late the next afternoon, I sent Clifford and Elizabeth away from the laboratory. I wanted to study my notes alone, and there now seemed no purpose in watching the silent cylinder all the time. Also, Elizabeth seemed to be growing more depressed each day, as if something were weighing on her mind. She and Clifford retired rather discouraged, probably to spend the evening at their usual coffee bar, and I went home. At about 11 o'clock that night in my study in Eaton Square, I was examining a thick folder of calculations and diagrams. Professor McLaren, who had arrived with it an hour before, watched me curiously.
Well... Is it or isn't it?
Campbell, I want to be the first to congratulate you. These figures are conclusive. A large orbiting body within the solar system. There can be only one explanation. A new tenth planet.
Orbit 10.
That's it. It's been suspected for years. A planet so distant, so dark, that no telescope, even yours, can detect it.
No. No, we would never have known without those signals. But that's where they're coming from, Hayward. Signals from the tenth planet.
It must be enormous, possibly even larger than Jupiter. A vast, frozen giant. And its journey around the sun must take something like 700 years. I wonder, Campbell.
Yes?
Well, suppose those cylinders of mine, scattered over the Earth, have some connection with it. They take in solid matter and it vanishes completely. It's a fantastic process and it must have a purpose. Is it possible that they absorb substances in order to transmit them elsewhere? To send them perhaps back to where the cylinders themselves came from? Back across space? Back to the tenth planet itself? If so, we're up against something so big we don't realize it's staring us in the face.
Coffee, Liz?
Hmm?
That one must be cold.
Oh, no thanks. I'm not hungry.
I only said... Oh, I'll skip it. Well, if the Martians are on the way, they surely have a lulu of a technique. Nerve warfare. And we're the first victims. Any time now, we'll be at one another's throats.
Oh, Cliff, don't. Don't say things like that, even in fun.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Should we talk about the weather?
I'm tired. I think I'll go and... Oh, I left my file of notes in the lab, and I want to write them up at home. I'd better slip back and get them.
Not alone, you don't. Petrie won't be there. I'll walk up to the college with you.
No, I'd rather be on my own. I'll ring you tomorrow.
Okay. I'll stay here a bit.
Sorry, Cliff.
No, forget it.
Good night.
Night.
Elizabeth left the coffee bar at exactly 11:35. She walked into Cromwell Road, entered the deserted college, and took the lift up to the third floor. Reaching the laboratory and switching on the lights, the first thing she did was look quickly at the rod standing in the denser-like cubicle. It was dull and silent. Elizabeth could see her own pale face reflected, distorted in its polished green surface. Automatically, she ran her eye over the recording instruments. The meter needles were all quite still. Near the cubicle lay the cylinder, a huge, empty shell. She smiled. Already dust was gathering on it. She collected her folder of papers from the bench and walked back towards the door. Then she stopped. Even before she looked round, she knew. By the air becoming colder each second, chilling, biting, and by the slow flood of unearthly green light which bathed the wall, confronting her with her own black, rearing shadow. And as she spun round, her breath made a white cloud and something crackled under her feet, frost, forming rapidly, white and glinting. The green glare from the rod growing fiercer hurt her eyes. Then the vibration, rattling the benches and apparatus, dinning in her ears and dulling her mind. She found herself walking against her will towards the cubicle, her aching eyes fixed on the glowing core of the rod. Something seemed to be drawing her towards it. She bumped something. It clicked as she put out a hand, but she went on. She cried out, but her voice seemed not to belong to her, to come from a vast distance. Seconds passed. There was no thought in her mind. And then something seemed to burn her fingers. Forcing her eyes down, she saw it was the lock bar of the cabinet, white with ice. She had lifted it, and the door was swinging open. Now she was very close to the blazing rod, and softly, silently, a gray vapor was beginning to seep from its surface. With a frantic effort, she forced herself to think, to move, to step back. But the noise wouldn't let her think. Something somewhere was calling, demanding, willing her to obey. Her eyes fell on the laboratory telephone. One clear thought, one hope came, and she clung to it.
Telephone. Cliff. Coffee bar. Phone number. Seen it so often. Phone number on the menus. Think. Sloan. 01. Number on the menus. Sloan. Yes. 0181.
The frozen steel of the telephone dial bit at her fingers. It seemed to take all her strength to turn it, release it, it whirred back. Her mind was blurring, slipping away again. Another one. And another. And another.
Hello? Oh, yes, he is here. I tell him. Hey, Mr. Clifford, your young lady is on the phone for you.
Okay.
Hello? Cliff here. Is that you, Liz? Hello?
Oh, Cliff, I tried. I didn't know if...
Hey, Liz, what's wrong?
Oh, Cliff, please come. Please. I can't fight it much longer.
Well, Liz, what is it? Are you in the lab?
Yes. Cliff, help me. I mustn't go back to...
Liz. Liz! Honey, hang on. Whatever it is, hang on. I'll be right with you. Liz, are you in there? Liz, for heaven's sake, can you hear me?
Clifford had reached the college, the doors of the laboratory. They wouldn't open. Something had fallen across them, jamming them on the inside. Peering helplessly through the glass panels, he saw grey, swirling vapor. The room was choked with it, and everywhere a wintry whiteness of frost and ice. He saw dimly the open cubicle and the rod glowing a dull green. The telephone and its receiver, just clear of the floor, swinging slowly on its cord. But there was no sign of Elizabeth. The laboratory seemed quite empty. From London, we present Orbit 10, a play in 6 episodes by Peter Elliott Hayes. Episode 5, The Frozen World.
Tom Lambert here again. A strange cylinder buried beneath a northern beach. Then another, glowing in the depths of a Welsh coal mine. And now we knew there were more, scattered over England and Europe, perhaps all over the globe, freezing everything that came near them and causing solid matter to vanish from the face of the earth, possibly even transmitting it across the vastnesses of space. In the 4th recording, you heard how Elizabeth returned alone to the laboratory, how the cylinder began to operate with a new intensity. Now, we were very near to understanding the whole unbelievable truth. Here is the 5th recording.
If I had known that night the terrible risk Elizabeth had taken, but I was a mile away, sitting by my study fire with McLaren. Clifford knew, though. He could see the writhing mist, the white fur of frost smothering everything, the telephone swinging mutely on its cord, but not Elizabeth Ryder.
Liz! Liz, are you in there? Liz, for heaven's sake, can you hear me? Got to get these doors open.
Clifford moved across the passage and hurled himself bodily at the doors. They burst in, sending something rasping across the floor, a filing cabinet that had toppled across them on the inside. Dreadful, paralyzing cold closed about him. This was nothing we had seen before. The whole laboratory was an arctic landscape. The apparatus, the benches, no more than humped shapes beneath the coating of ice. Grotesque, glittering icebergs. The densolite cubicle had become a nightmare refrigerator. A hollow case of ice containing the only thing unchanged, the rod, its green flickering growing duller each second. Clifford tottered and fell heavily. The floor itself was a gleaming sheet of ice. He dragged himself up, and then he gasped with relief.
Liz!
Oh, thank heaven. I thought maybe you... Oh, no. Liz.
Hidden from the doors, Elizabeth was lying between the benches, and she was very still. Her clothing, her hair, were white with frost. Her face was white and pinched, and her eyes were closed. Clifford crawled to her side, tried to lift her, but her coat, stiff as a board, was frozen fast to the floor.
No good. I'll have to get some help.
He tried the telephone, but the dial wouldn't turn. The instrument was frozen solid. He staggered from the laboratory, raced down the passage into my study, and dialed 999. Some hours later, in the quiet of a hospital ward, Clifford, McLaren and myself stood at the bedside of a white-faced, shaken, but still living Elizabeth, waiting till she could tell us her story.
Hi, Liz.
Hello, Cliff.
You should have stayed for that other coffee. How are you feeling?
Cold. Still very cold. Sorry to be such a nuisance, Doctor.
Oh, my dear child.
I shouldn't have gone back.
Well, you weren't to know. Now, don't talk if you don't want to, my dear.
I do want to, but...
Well, can you tell us what happened?
It was so cold. Ice was just growing on everything. I knew I had to telephone. I tried to remember the coffee bar number. Did I?
Sure you did. You got through.
When I arrived up there, the whole darn place was turning into a glacier.
But before that, Miss Ryder, how did it begin? Why did you want to telephone? Why did you not just come out?
I don't know. I was leaving when it started. I remember seeing my own shadow on the wall. Then the noise, that awful noise. I couldn't think because of the other sounds.
What other sounds?
Strange sounds. I couldn't understand them.
Elizabeth, try to remember.
I can't. My mind wouldn't work.
Elizabeth, what other sounds did you hear? You must tell me.
Like voices. Quiet, gentle voices. Whispering. I tried to understand them. They wanted to be understood. And I knew I could if only... But it was so cold.
Go on, go on.
I wanted to go nearer. To hear them better.
Nearer? What? To the cubicle?
Yes. They wanted me to. And I was talking. I remember now I kept on talking.
Yes.
I don't know what I said. I couldn't take my eyes off the rod. That green light. I wanted to be close to it. To be warm.
And then? Oh, Elizabeth, stay awake.
Sorry. Then I suddenly felt frightened.
Yes?
I knew I mustn't. I had to keep the voices out of my head. I just kept on thinking of the telephone. I thought, if I can just get to the telephone. It should have been black, but it had turned white. It hurt my hands.
Yes.
And then, oh, why can't they make this room warm?
He would leave her alone.
Yes, I can. Thank you, my dear. Have a good rest. You've more than earned it. I think we should go now.
So long, Liz. The doctor says you should be fit enough to come out tomorrow.
Thanks, Cliff. I keep on getting rescued by you. I mustn't let it become a habit.
She's almost asleep. Come along.
We went back to the college, to the laboratory. The ice had all disappeared, but the place looked as if a flood had swept through it. It was late. We were all exhausted. There seemed nothing more we could do. We stood there aimlessly, helplessly, while the water dripped dismally around us. Well, I don't know.
Voices whispering, wanting to be understood. Doctor, was she just a bit light-headed, or did she really hear something?
Yes, Clifford, I believe she did. That was why she stayed. She had to.
Heywood, are you telling us that that object spoke? That a voice came from it?
Not a voice, but something that was able to reach her mind, that wanted to communicate with it.
Aye, and the signals reaching the telescope. Again, an attempt at communication.
Exactly.
It must fit together. Two forms, perhaps, of the same thing.
Hey, Doctor, look at this.
What is it?
The tape recorder. It's running.
And the tape half-used.
It switched to record. It wasn't operating when I bust in here, but it is now.
And the microphone is still connected. Clifford, you said Elizabeth fell about here.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, suppose she stumbled against it, pressed her hand down on it.
And switched it on. It would have started recording.
Yes. And gone on until the cold froze the motor to a standstill.
And it's only just thawed and started up again. Clifford, take the tape off. I have a recorder at home. We can try it there. This place is still uncomfortably chilly. And before we go, make quite certain the cubicle is properly secured. After this, no one is to be alone in here, not for 1 minute.
I've got the tape laced up, sir.
Let's hear it, then. Though I doubt if it picked up much under those conditions.
Here she goes, then.
Nothing.
Oh, it has to warm up. Ah, listen.
Hey, that's it. The rod going flat out. She did start it going.
Shh. Seen it so often. Phone number on the menus. Think.
She was trying to get me at the coffee bar. And I was sitting down there feeling so sorry for myself. If I'd have known what she was doing.
Listen. Cliff, please come. Please. I can't fight it much longer. Yes. Cliff, help me. I mustn't go back.
She dropped the receiver.
Yes. Now, those vital 4 minutes before you got to the laboratory. If we can hear what happened in that time, though we must.
Hey, listen to that. It never made that noise before.
Now she's walking towards it, getting near the cubicle.
Who are you? Yes, I can hear, but you are so far away. I will try to understand. The cylinders come from your world. Many were lost on the journey, but many have landed safely. Yes, we are in no danger. No danger. You intend us no harm. Yes. The cylinders are your way of exploring our planet, which you believe may be inhabited. Yes. They collect samples, solids and gases. Transmit them back for analysis. Yes. In this way, you are surveying our world without leaving your own. To you, space and time are not impassable barriers.
Heywood, do you hear? This is...
Wait!
Now you are trying to communicate with us directly. Yes. If we are intelligent beings, we are to answer. Yes. Yes, we do understand. But how are we to answer? It is so cold. Yes, I am trying. Yes, there may be another way. We are not to be afraid if you take the next step. If you use the rods to... What?
Oh. And that's all we shall hear, I suppose. That was when the recorder finally froze up and stopped. It's a wonder it kept going as long as it did.
Well, Heywood, you were right. Voices from the 10th planet.
Yes. An inhabited planet, Campbell. Though by what inconceivable form of life?
Aye, what?
So that is the purpose of the cylinders. What incredible technology. No clumsy rockets, no feeble attempts to land on a planet where conditions might be dangerous to them. No. First, a systematic, remote-controlled survey. 50 years... By now, they must have built up a complete knowledge of the Earth's composition. Its geology, its atmosphere, its lands, its oceans. Oh. And we fondly imagine that we are far advanced in science.
Well, at least one weight's off our minds. They're not hostile.
No.
They're still only seeking knowledge. Thank heaven there's no danger after all.
No, no danger. They seem anxious to reassure us on that.
Obviously, they have no way of coming here, even if they wanted to. That distance, it's out of the question.
Well, that may be just as well. What manner of creatures can exist there? A frozen planet, 100 times the size of Earth, 5,000 million miles away. It can be no biochemical life as we understand it.
Yeah, but what's that they said? Time and space are not impassable barriers. They said that.
Quite so.
Well, you must act on this as you think best. I must get back. I've been too long away from the telescope already. When I left, young Garrick was working like a maniac.
On the signals, you mean?
Yes. He's pretty sure the breakthrough isn't far off now.
Well, we must know if they're part of the same project. We can suppose now that they are. But it's strange that they were not mentioned in the message that Elizabeth understood.
Aye, that's odd. But once we can find the basic key to those transmissions... We'll know.
And I must see Lord Heatherton again tomorrow. He must hear this recording. Perhaps there is no real urgency now if one keeps a safe distance from the cylinders, but all the same...
There's just one thing on my mind, sir.
What's that?
We didn't get the end of that message. The tape stopped too soon.
It did.
Liz did, but she can't remember.
No.
We were not to be afraid if they used the rods to take the next step. Now, that's what gets me. What else could they be used for? What next step?
The next day was sunny, and I felt easier in my mind than I had for a long while. But a shadowy doubt still lurked. We had made a momentous discovery. We seemed, at last, to have reached the truth. Then, why did I feel that the pieces had dropped into place too conveniently? Was there still something we had overlooked? I was just leaving for Whitehall when Tom Lambert arrived.
He had been busy since I last saw him, and he wasted no time. He slapped a thick sheaf of papers on my desk. The neat teleprinter type, page after page of it, told a disturbing story.
Here's the first installment, Doctor, straight off the wires. They're coming in thick and fast. The Ministry teamed up with the Foreign Office. They've got every foreign news service working overtime.
And these are all accounts of the same kind of phenomena?
Yeah, dug out of newspaper files all over the known world. And like ours, they go back for 50 years and more.
Well, let's have a look. Yes, everywhere. Australia, Alaska, Norway, South America.
Yeah.
Even one from the Philippines.
And in every case, the same symptoms. Earth tremors, vibration, violent drops in temperature. In a few places, the things were seen to land.
Were there?
A streak of blue-white light. A quick concussion and then just a small hole in the ground.
Well, they would arrive white hot after passing through the atmosphere.
In many cases, they were assumed to be meteorites. But they go down so deep, they're impossible to dig out.
Well, they must strike the Earth at tremendous speed.
I'll say.
The one we found under that beach must somehow have been slowed down, perhaps through colliding with a real meteor shower.
Hmm.
And how many of these are there?
Well, so far, 208.
208?
And the reports are still coming in.
Oh, the Minister must see these too. Distributed over the entire surface of the globe. So many, just for a survey.
What was that, Doctor?
Oh, I was just thinking aloud.
Oh.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lambert. By the way, we've come to the conclusion that there's no serious danger from these things.
Oh?
Provided they are kept at a respectful distance.
Well, let's hope you're right, Doctor, because I've got a news flash, too. Our South Wales correspondent tells me that troops have moved in.
Moved in where?
Llanwethlyn.
Good heavens.
Yeah, they're mounting a guard on the old pit. Seems the official view is a little less confident than yours.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, I must be going. I'll pass on anything I can.
Well, thanks, Doctor. I'll be around. I have a small theory of my own. I think we may be comparing notes again before long.
Half an hour later, I was again in that quiet high room behind Whitehall. Lord Heatherton's face was more serious than it had been before. He listened to the tape recording and examined the bundle of reports.
Well, this is really only what we expected, isn't it, Doctor? Except bigger. Over 200 cylinders.
So many and so evenly distributed.
No country, no corner of the world overlooked. Rather like some enormous spy system. As you say, why should they need so many? And that recording. We are dealing with something quite outside our knowledge. But if their intentions really are peaceful, is there any way we can reply?
Well, according to Professor McLaren, none at present. In time, a signaling apparatus might be built, and it might be powerful enough to send short waves to the 10th planet.
A lot of mights, Doctor.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Anyway, I'll tell you what we are doing about this. Plotting every suspected site in this country, guarding each one we confirm with an army unit.
Yes, I heard.
The public must be protected. Our delegate is addressing the United Nations Scientific Commission today. Then I hope the same will happen abroad. Detecting, plotting, and observation of sites. And here in this red folder is another scheme I've drawn up.
Oh.
I can't tell you the details yet, but they are also being put before the Commission.
What sort of scheme?
Just certain emergency measures, should they for any reason become necessary.
Yes, no, but I do...
I know what you are going to say. This is knowledge, vital knowledge. We must be on our guard against any instinctive hostility, I agree. But better safe than sorry, Doctor.
I see. But what do we do immediately?
A famous politician once said a famous saying, wait and see. Carry on with your work for another week. If no new developments occur, then I shall arrange for several other cylinders to be excavated.
And then?
Already there are some high-level proposals, an international authority to decide how best to develop this interplanetary contact, and research centers will be needed, an international fund coordination.
Yes, of course. Another week. And then it'll be out of my hands.
Not entirely. There will be work as part of a team for all the specialists we have. Your lecturing on cosmic science will be valuable.
My lecturing?
This is a big event in the history of our small world, Doctor. We must be big enough, each in our own way, to meet it.
Yes, I understand.
Now perhaps you'll excuse me. I have rather a lot to do. I have to report to Parliament this afternoon. And I rather think all the honorable members will stay awake to listen to me today.
Outside, Whitehall was grey and cold. The sun had gone. A steady drizzle was falling.
The cars and buses elbowed each other. The passers-by huddled into their coats and went on their million and one different errands. Everything was as it should be on a dismal November London afternoon. So solid, so normal. What, I found myself saying, can possibly change any of this? The few slabs of coloured plastic we were making such a to-do about? It suddenly seemed absurd. Oh, how little we knew then. I drove back to the college. I went up to the laboratory and stood looking at the rod, dark and silent in the cubicle. Would we ever know? And anyway, in a few days it would be taken away. I hardly heard the doors open behind me.
We thought you might be here. Hello, Doctor.
Hello, Doctor.
Elizabeth, Clifford. Oh, I was daydreaming. How are you, my dear?
Quite all right now.
Good.
They let me out this morning. Cliff told me about the recording I seem to have made. I still don't remember. He didn't want me to come here again, but I wanted to see that. It told me something, more than was on the tape, and I repeated it. But it's gone.
Well, it may come back to you. In any case, our work's nearly over. Special authorities, international funds. There'll be no place for us. Oh, well, it had to happen. What I can possibly do in 1 week.
I could try again. I think I can send it.
No, I won't hear of it. You've done your share, Elizabeth. Another time, that terrible freezing, you might not be so lucky. Now we can only wait. The next morning, Saturday, the newspapers exploded. Theories, speculations, accusations, advice. Plenty of advice. The story had broken at last. By 11, my house was besieged by reporters. Every reporter in London, it seemed, except Tom Lambert. My front doorbell and telephone rang furiously until I disconnected them both. I saw no one all day and I spoke to no one. I slept badly that night. I kept hearing the sound of the cylinder. And once, I think it was 3 a.m, I got up and rang the college. But the disgruntled voice of Simmons assured me that all was quiet in the laboratory. The next day was the same. Now the tireless gentleman of the press resorted to the door knocker. I couldn't do much about that. Then 3 solid policemen appeared outside and peace returned. Late in the afternoon, Clifford and Elizabeth called. I was glad to see them and asked them to stay for dinner. It was a silent meal. The wind seemed very strong outside, rattling the windows behind the curtains and scurrying round the deserted square. We were not to know it then, but elsewhere the night was even wilder. Far away, a bitter gale was lashing the Isle of Skara and howling through the girders of the radio telescope high above Kirkcudbright.
Larry, you're sure about this? You can't have made a mistake.
I broke the code this afternoon. Stumbled on it almost by accident. Once I confirmed the 10 basic groups, the rest just fell into place. I got this clear transcription from the first long sequence I tried.
But it's English.
Oh, it is now. But it could be any language. The signals don't convey a letter alphabet. They're a series of numerical progressions representing shades of meaning. A sort of mathematical grammar.
And this is what you've translated so far?
I'll work through the rest as fast as I can.
This is enough. Goodness gracious, Peter. If this is true, I must talk to Petrie. He must know about this at once.
We were sitting round the fire when the telephone rang. At first we ignored it. But it wouldn't stop. At last, I asked Clifford to answer it.
Yeah? Yes, he's here. Hold on, will you? Doctor, it's Professor McLaren calling from Skara.
Oh, I wouldn't like his phone bill. Hello, Campbell.
Hayward?
Yes.
Hayward, Garrick has broken the signal code.
What? When?
A few hours ago. He's translated a passage. I've got the paper here.
What? What does it say?
I'd better read it. It's short enough. Are you listening?
Yes, yes.
If the cylinders speak, do not believe what they say. your planet is in great danger. Destroy them.
Good heavens.
That's repeated three times. Then, when the great cold comes, it will be too late.
The great cold? Is that all?
Aye. Garrick's at work on the rest. I'll be down tomorrow, Heywood. I'll get a plane.
Good.
Let's hope it isn't as bad as I think it is.
Yes. Well, thank you, Campbell. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Well, did you hear that, Clifford? If the cylinders speak, do not believe them.
Then all that about peaceful intentions and seeking knowledge.
Well, it's to throw us off our guard, to save the cylinders. Perhaps so that... Oh, what a monumental idiot I've been. The 10th planet, in some way, it must be divided. That's why signals have been coming from two directions. And if the cylinders transmit matter, well, of course, we must go to the laboratory. There's no knowing how much time we have.
Is still out.
I was half expecting.
Oh, quiet now. It's only waiting. Don't you see, either of you? This marvel of creation we've come close to worshipping, it can beam matter across space. We've known that for weeks, but we've been blind. If it can transmit in one direction, it can do it in the other. From Earth to the 10th orbit. Oh.
From there to here.
Precisely.
But what would they need to send through?
Oh, themselves. Whatever they are, themselves. We've heard their voices. Next time, we shall see them.
But the next step, we were not to be afraid. We were to wait to help them.
Doctor, look. The rod. It's starting to flicker.
Oh.
The green light. It's beginning. It must be. And the cold. Can you feel it?
Well, we must choose now. Knowledge or survival. Clifford,
yeah?
The builders left a sledgehammer in the passage. Get it. Get it, I say.
Okay.
What are you going to do?
Do what primitive man did when he saw danger. Fight.
Here it is.
Some hammer. Must weigh 30 pounds.
Elizabeth, open the cabinet.
Open.
Do as I say quickly.
All right.
Now, tip the rod over. Pull it. It won't hurt you yet. I'll help you.
All right.
Right. There it is, Clifford. Now, use those Canadian muscles of yours. Smash it.
Yeah, but we can't just...
Smash it, I tell you. If you won't, I shall have to.
Okay.
Stand back. Here it goes, then. It won't break.
Harder. Harder! All your strength, Clifford! It must break, it must!
Oh, it's hopeless! Won't even tip!
The ice! Look! The ice! It's coming!
It's no good! They knew it would come to this! They planned, they made sure! Nothing can destroy this thing! Nothing!
From London, we present Orbit 10, a play in 6 episodes by Peter Elliott Hayes. Episode 6, The Unseen.
Lambert here. This is the last time I shall be speaking to you. I've done what I intended. And now only those last unforgettable days remain to be told. A 10th planet, 5,000 million miles distant. And yet on that windy November night, no farther than the flickering green rod in a Kensington building. This was the Link. A frail door separating our world from a frozen giant on the rim of space. Now it was opening. And what would cross the threshold?
Here is Dr. Petrie's sixth and last recording.
Final notes on 10th planet. We had had our warning. The signals had told us the true purpose of the scattered network of cylinders. And now the hour of the rods had come. Not now to absorb another telltale specimen of our Earth, but to send something through. But our understanding had come too slowly. Even as Clifford's hammer rang on the unbreakable green surface, I knew we were too late. I felt as he did. Nothing could destroy this thing, nothing. We hurried to my study. Then telephone calls to Bancroft, head of the college, to the Ministry of Science, to the police. I felt we were going to need their help. Meanwhile, the terrible freezing went on. Some hours later, the whole corridor passing the laboratory, for full 30 yards each way, had become one shining, low-roofed tunnel of solid ice. Out of it swept gusts of bitterly cold air. It was like looking into the dead, green-lit heart of an iceberg. And somewhere in the dim, frozen cavern that had been the laboratory, the rod still throbbed angrily. The night passed. The freezing continued, but nothing more. With the dawn of Sunday morning came fog, a blanket of good, honest fog beneath which all London peered and coughed, and which shrouded the Victorian spires and turrets of the college. 10 o'clock, we were back at my house for welcome coffee and buttered toast, and a telephone bell I was beginning to dread. It was Elizabeth who saw the black and silver limousine stop outside, and the short, overcoated figure who hurried up the steps. It was Lord Heatherton. And the minister, it appeared, had set many wheels in motion.
The college told me I'd find you here. Well, Doctor, I had my own forebodings, but nothing as alarming as this. Perhaps we shall get a clearer picture when McLaren deciphers the rest of those signals.
He's on his way here now. He's flying down from Scotland. We should know something soon.
I hope so. Meantime, that rod is turning your college into one huge refrigerator.
It certainly is.
Creating the conditions they are used to.
Undoubtedly.
Well, the police are watching from every possible vantage point.
Yes.
If any other phenomena develop, we shall hear.
Good. And the other cylinders, this may be the first of many.
You recall that red file?
Yeah, I do.
We are putting the emergency measures into effect at once.
Oh.
So long as the plotted cylinders are passive, they will be left for the time being. But wherever activity is seen, I'm afraid it is going to be dealt with. After that warning, we can take no chances.
How dealt with, sir?
The army. Bulldozers and excavating parties first. Then troops with mortars and demolition charges. If that is not enough, there are tanks and heavy artillery standing by.
Oh, my word.
And if necessary, there is bomber command.
Explosives? I wonder.
I think we can cope. That specimen in the college is the one we must watch.
I quite agree, sir.
That is our guide to what to expect later from all the rest. If that turns out to be a damp squib, there may be nothing to worry about.
Let's hope so.
No, I must get back to Whitehall. Reports from the War Office should be coming in any time now. If there is any news, let me know at once.
Certainly.
Yes, of course.
Lord Heatherton's car slid away into the fog. A few minutes later, a taxi chugged out of it and deposited McLaren and Peter Garrick on the pavement. With the future of the world in the balance, I observed Campbell still found 3 minutes to wrangle with the driver over the fare. But when he was pacing my study, gripping a bundle of papers, there were grim lines around his mouth, and his eyes were without hope.
Aye, we've decoded the rest. The last section on the plane coming down. We chartered a private one at Renfrew. It's all here, Hayward.
Yes,
an intelligent, lucid history. Successes and setbacks on a world we can't even begin to imagine. And a disaster.
Disaster?
Look, it'll save time if Garrick just gives you the gist of it. Tell them, Peter.
Well, the 10th planet is inhabited. Not by one dominant species as here, but by two.
By two?
Yes, two races who've always kept to their respective sides of the planet. Alien, hostile, endlessly at what we would call a cold war.
No truer word in those temperatures.
No, quite so.
The inhabitants of the site receiving what little light and heat there is are highly advanced technologically. 50 years ago, in our time, they perfected the system of sending the surveying cylinders across space to Earth, which they considered the planet most likely to support organic life.
I see.
The method we know now, how the cylinders assimilated samples, dismantled them into individual molecules, and beamed them back. At the other end, there are special receivers, and they're reintegrated for examination. Well, so far, so good. And this, originally, was the only purpose of the cylinders. Mm. Then the blow fell.
What blow?
Well, they were suddenly and ruthlessly overrun by the inferior beings from the other face of the planet. The signals refer to them as the Dark Ones.
The Dark Ones.
They took control of the system and soon discovered that the samples coming back were rich in chemicals and minerals.
Substances rare to them.
Yes, we became a desirable bait, an ideal potential mining colony.
Of course. Gravity, free water, and plenty of solar heat.
Yes, I see.
And the means were already here, planted in 1,000 different spots. So the plan took shape. First, communication.
To assure us of the harmlessness of the rod.
Yes. And then, themselves. To explore Earth at first hand.
The Dark Ones. They're very confident in themselves, Hayward, because they've done it once already.
What?
Our moon.
The moon?
Chosen for a pilot experiment.
No.
They landed cylinders and sent a number of their creatures through. It worked, and they got back. Now they're ready for the full-scale operation. Us.
The next step.
Yes,
the next step.
What the Dark Ones did not discover was a high-frequency radio transmitter, another part of the original survey. It had been beaming signals for a long time, in the hope of making semantic contact with us. And it was continuing to operate in secret. But now it sent out warnings. Endless, repeated warnings. There was just a chance we might understand and be ready.
And, that's all?
No, not quite. There's another short sequence, but it's very distorted. I'm still working on it. I think the Dark Ones have detected the signals, and I think they're jamming them.
And nothing to tell us what these beings, these Dark Ones, are like?
No, nothing at all. What could evolve out there? Gravity to make a human weigh 500 tons... Perpetual near darkness with temperatures close to absolute zero.
Incredible. Those cells, a human would be 3 miles high. We can't begin to imagine, Campbell.
No, indeed.
And we can't wait and wait until that ghastly thing up there...
Maybe the waiting's over.
Yes. Yes, speaking. I see. When was this? Yes, I'll come at once. The college. Something's happened. The rod has stopped.
Stopped?
Yes. But there are still noises. New noises. We'd better go.
It seems to be over, the freezing, the vibration. But now there's something else. It comes and goes. Listen. Do you hear? It's not in the laboratory, though it's on that side of the building. Lower down.
And it seems to be moving about. We must go up, if we can get close enough to see.
You wrap yourselves up. No one take their gloves off. The cold up there is terrible.
We climbed the 6 flights again. Frost on the stairs. Our feet left prints in it. Now almost the entire 3rd floor was a nightmare Arctic landscape of ice. But it was dripping, thawing. We picked our way along white tunnels that had been corridors and reached the laboratory. There was a mound of solid ice. The densolite cubicle entombed. It was silent. And then... We followed the sound, stumbling and slithering along the ice-encrusted passages. It was a strange, unreal hunt, our breath making white clouds in the freezing air. We reached the landing with the lift and stopped.
Hayward, look!
Those lift gates.
The steel trellis ripped to pieces.
And the sliding doors, like a car's been driven through.
This lift stuck on the floor above. Don't go too near the edge. It's a long drop.
Do you hear it? It's coming from the shaft. I must...
Don't lean out there, sir. One slip and you've had it. Just kneel down. I'll hold on to your coat.
Can you see anything?
Yes. Yes, I can. There's something down there. It fills the bottom of the shaft. Gray. Moving. Pulsing. But not solid. It's more like a cloud. But it has a kind of outline, a shape.
It has happened. One of them has come through. Now the police took matters into their own hands. In 10 minutes, Cromwell Road was empty and closed to traffic. Surrounding buildings were emptied, and their bewildered occupants escorted out of the area. Still the fog pressed down. It was soon clear that the grey vapour was seeping out of the lift shaft into the basement. The rumbling grew more frequent and more violent. Now things were happening in Simmons' domain, and he led us down to a storeroom where there was a ventilating grill through which the basement could be seen. We peered through, and there it was. Vapor. A gray, shifting pool. Shapeless, yet keeping a compact mass with a dull, billowing surface. Still for long minutes, then flattening and rolling silently as if seeking a way out.
Incredible.
And that's it. A living, solid thing.
Living, but not solid. Well, it's logical, of course. A planet as massive, as cold as that. Beings with very loose molecular structure. Not affected by the tremendous gravity. Little more to our eyes than a gas. Able to expand or contract themselves at will.
And cold. Cold as the place they came from.
We went up again to meet Tom Lambert hurrying across the hall.
Well, Mr. Lambert, come to say I told you so. I think this is no surprise to you.
Well, the cylinder's operating in reverse, you mean? It struck me as a possibility.
Oh, it struck you as a possibility. Not worth mentioning, of course.
Sorry, Doctor, but it was only a guess. And I assumed they could be knocked out if they got troublesome. Seems I was wrong.
Mr. Lambert, we're not your admiring readers. You needn't dramatize it.
Sorry. But listen, the reports coming into the War Office, they're not good. Several of the cylinders have had the full treatment, shot at and blown up. The casings have split, but the rods haven't even cracked.
Oh, great heavens.
They tried tanks on Exmoor, but the engines froze before they could get near.
Well?
The Air Ministry are ready to try pinpoint bombing where they can, but if armor-piercing shells won't even scratch them...
I was afraid of this. Has anything else been reported?
Yeah. Several of them are operating violently. You know, green light, intense cold.
Aye, that's the pattern. 14 hours of freezing.
The energy build-up.
Then the breakthrough. This one is ahead of the others.
Excuse me, Doctor, police here.
Yes, Superintendent.
Oh, Doctor, we've got some asbestos suits from the fire service. Two of my men have got into the basement.
What? Oh, for heaven's sake, they...
Oh, they needn't have worried. Apart from about 10 tons of ice, it's empty.
What?
The doors out to the car park have been torn off their hinges. Whatever it is that was in there, it's gone.
And then, in the fog, the real hunt began. By now, visibility was down to a few yards. One heard things. Footsteps, a car engine starting, a voice calling. But they seemed on the other side of a soft white wall. Constables groped about with flashlights, keeping in touch by blowing their whistles. The police cars, crawling cautiously, their headlights glowing like pairs of yellow eyes, fanned out. And others converged to join them from all over London. We stationed ourselves on the pavement outside the college by the superintendent's car. Its radio, in constant touch with the Scotland Yard control room, chattered continually, and its operators scribbled on their pads and handed the messages out to us. But we knew we were helpless.
This fog.
The thing couldn't have a better camouflage. The black cat in the coal cellar had nothing on this. And the thing is, what will it do?
Well, everything here is strange to it, Superintendent. It must explore. I think it'll be cautious at first.
And anyone meeting it?
The only warning may be the cold. After that... By the way, where is Peter Garrick?
He stayed behind at your house.
Yeah, I guess he wanted to keep working on the last sequence of signals.
Message from 7-2, sir. Junction of Brompton Road and Beaufort Gardens.
Right. Here's something. Ice in Brompton Road. A continuous trail. Some shop windows broken.
So it went that way, moving northeast.
Something gray seen on the road. They tried to shadow it, then the car engine packed up.
So it can absorb energy on its own.
Thank goodness it's Sunday. That road any other day and the shop's all open.
7-2 through again, sir. They've abandoned their car.
Let me see. A bus coming down Knightsbridge, its engines dropped too. Ice began to form all over it. Only a few passengers, they got off all right. Wilkins?
Yes, sir?
Tell them I want cars patrolling square. Knightsbridge, Kensington Road and Sloane Street.
Right, sir.
Report the moment they have engine trouble.
Yes, sir.
That seems the best indication.
No, I think it is.
If we could only confine it to one area. But how do you try to stop a drifting patch of vapor?
It's hopeless, Haywood. It can go where it likes, do what it likes. There is no way of stopping it. Another nerve-wracking hour passed. Things were found. An abandoned frozen bus, a thawing trail of ice, 15 feet wide, ending abruptly. Then more scraps of information. A frozen tree in Montpellier Square. A bent lamppost in Rutland Gate. A greenhouse collapsing under a coating of ice in Ennismore Gardens. It seemed to be moving north now, through the squares and back streets south of Hyde Park. The strangest thing was that, although it was traversing a thickly populated area, nothing had been seen. We were completely baffled, until...
Here's trouble. This message. Prince's Gardens, a chimney stack collapsed, went clean through the roof, occupants of house away. That was lucky. Nothing seen except a thick layer of ice on the roof.
Then that's the answer. Why, nobody's seen it. It can move about clear of the ground. Whenever it encounters an obstacle, it just goes over it.
Encouraging having you around, Doctor. So it's moving west now. If only it would settle for a short while. Perhaps we could do something.
For another anxious 40 minutes, nothing. The trail seemed completely lost. And then a voice suddenly crackled from the dashboard radio. A report short and urgent from a police car patrolling Kensington Gore on the south edge of Hyde Park. A report so strange and ominous that the superintendent could contain himself no longer. We bundled into his car and the one behind and swept away into the fog. Fifteen minutes later, we were standing on steps that were slippery with ice. Behind us reared the tall, ornamented spire of the Albert Memorial, and beyond, the empty wastes of Hyde Park. Across the road loomed the immense domed roundness of the Albert Hall. We knew then where the trail had ended.
Look at the place, covered in frost from the steps to the roof.
It's in there, in the Albert Hall.
Some of the doors were found smashed in. One of the caretakers went to investigate. There was the gray stuff seeping everywhere, along the passages, pouring over the galleries into the arena. He nearly collapsed with cold.
Then it's expanding, growing.
I'm afraid it is, but at least we know where it is.
Doctor, listen.
If this goes on, it'll shake the whole building down. It's getting out of control, Petrie.
There's another car. It's Peter Garrick.
Looking as if his life depended on that piece of paper.
Peter, what is it?
I couldn't find you. That last passage, I've got it. It may be some help.
Good.
It's in fragments, but... Well, there are some figures, a formula, I think. But the rest, this is the point... The rods require energy to function.
Aye, we know that.
But it must be in controlled amounts.
Ah.
They cannot tolerate too much at one time. It can damage them. Their one weakness.
An excess of energy, of power. Oh, if we could only... Oh, if we could...
But attacking that thing in the laboratory, it's not going to affect that. Not now.
I'm not so sure. That information was not sent without reason. In some way, the organism may still depend on the rod. There might be a way. The cyclotron in the atomic energy department at the college... It gets tremendous voltages.
Yeah, from the diesel electric generators.
Yes. They can be started up in a few minutes. They're on the ground floor, though. I have an idea, but it'll mean hard work and enough hands to do it.
I guess we can raise those, sir.
Then let's go back. Fog or no fog, Superintendent, your men have got to drive.
There's just a small chance, but every second is going to count.
It was a thin thread of hope, but we had to clutch at it. At the college, Clifford checked the fuel tanks. They were full. With six willing constables, we raided the electrical engineering floor for tools and a heavy drum of high-tension cable. The massive bank of generators was in a wing on the ground floor. The cable was run out. Clifford and McLaren were left to bear the end and connect up the steel and copper core. The rest of us set to work manhandling the cumbersome wooden drum up six flights of stairs, unreeling the tarred cable as we went. It was easier to reach the laboratory now, though much ice still remained. With hammers and wrenches, we chipped and levered until we'd freed the rod and toppled it from the cubicle. With numb hands, we rolled in the cable drum and unwound some more turns. I wanted a contact as close as possible. Four slithering policemen, straining on an iron bar, raised one end of the silent rod, and the rest of us struggled with the leathery serpent until we'd passed three loops round it. The telephone, now working again, rang. It was Clifford. The cable was connected up. We should soon know now. I made everyone stand back and gave the signal to run up the generators. It was Elizabeth who remembered that the Albert Hall could be seen from the college roof. Telling Clifford to increase the current steadily, we hurried to the iron staircase and were soon standing among the chimney stacks and skylights, peering across the jumbled Kensington rooftops. The fog seemed thinner up there. We could just make out the domed mass of the Albert Hall a quarter of a mile away. It had a strange, white, luminous appearance.
Ice.
The whole place is smothered in it.
The power should be building up by now. At full speed, those generators produce enough to supply all London twice over.
And more than enough to burn out that cable. What are we doing, Edward? Fighting something we haven't a chance against. We're so small, so weak against that.
Well, what I was thinking. Wait. Listen.
Now, but if we can hear it from here, it's growing stronger. The strength there, unimaginable strength.
Doctor! The rod, it's glowing again. Getting brighter as the current increases.
Then it is absorbing the power.
But Hayward, don't you see? We're not attacking it, we're helping it. Feeding it with energy. This is just what it wants.
I can't help it. Those signals can't be wrong. It's a chance we must take. It may be our only hope.
If this goes on, that thing's growing. If it shatters the building and bursts out. Petrie, you must stop this.
I can't, Edward. Those voices, I believe them. I believe they wanted to save us.
What can we believe? There's no truth anymore. Do you want to unleash that? For pity's sake, tell Bowen to cut off the generator.
No!
If you don't, you may be responsible for...
You hear that? An explosion? It shook the building. It must have been in the laboratory. Come on!
The rod, when we all stood staring at it, had changed. It was dull and clouded. It had cracked in a thousand places. The tracery of silver wires was black and fused. It had seemed too much to hope, but it had happened. We clung to our hope as we raced to the Albert Hall. And when, 15 minutes later, we were standing in the ice-cold amphitheater, we knew the threat had passed. Water dripped everywhere, but it was empty. Within minutes of the fusing of the rod, the vapor had become still, thinned, and disappeared.
Forgive me, Hayward. You were right. And you had the courage to believe in yourself.
The power was too much for it. Burnt it out. And this thing couldn't survive without it.
And if that rod couldn't take it, nor can any of the others. They can all be treated in the same way.
Yeah, any powerful electric circuit run near them. Well, I guess all over the world, a lot of electricians had better get busy.
Yes, it must be done as soon as possible.
It came a long way, and this was the end of the journey. Did it hate us? Did it only want to conquer and destroy? Or, at the end, was it just trapped and alone? Could we have understood it?
The tragedy is we shall never know. But there is a lesson, perhaps, for us. If we ever go out into space, as we shall, we must leave our differences, our quarrels, behind. If we carry them with us to other worlds, as these did, we shall be condemned from the start, as they were. And that, I suppose, ends my notes. The rest, that has become history. The burning out of the cylinders, wherever they were found. The fading away of the signals, which have never been detected since. Whether because they had served their purpose, or because the senders were themselves overrun, we can only guess. But the link with the 10th planet was broken. Perhaps for all time. That was all years ago. As I sit here and dusk falls over the green countryside, I wonder, is it a law of the universe that each race be bound to the surface of its own world, that we belong where we begin? A law that will eventually punish all who flout it? I do not know. But, as I say, I wonder.
In the final part of Orbit 10 by Peter Elliott Hayes, you heard Felix Felton as Dr. Petrie, David Spencer as Tom Lambert, Graydon Gould as Clifford Brown, Elaine McNamara as Elizabeth Ryder, and Ian Sadler as Professor Campbell McLaren. Harold Rees was Peter Garrick, William Fox, Sir Edward Bancroft, Charles West, Lord Hatherton, and Eric Lugg, the police superintendent. And the producer was David Davis.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy what I'm doing, I ask you to please subscribe to my channel or channels. Well, hope you enjoyed, and until next time, stay safe, wish you well, peace.